You're listening to 340B Unscripted.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. My name is Greg Wilson, here with my co-host, Robin Hoopy. Hoopy, what's happening, man?
Not much. Enjoying a good week of just getting work done in the office. So how about yourself?
Yeah, same. Catching up. Been out on audits, supporting some HRSA audits over the last couple of weeks. So this is a down week for me, at least, to catch up on emails and some other kind of educational stuff that we're working on. So,
yeah, that's a good point. I had a HRSA audit last week as well. I attended for one of our clients, and It is quite busy leading up to that. So it's nice to kind of finish that, be done, and just playing catch up for a while. Yeah, I'm excited for some discussions today.
Yeah. So the main topic of our episode today is going to be wrapping up our part of the data request list review for HRSA audits. So the last couple of episodes, we had Megan and Jasmine from our team provide some grantee-specific perspectives. We have not finished talking on our end of the last two items. So section number 8 is self-disclosure documents and section 9 is Medicaid billing details. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Let's catch up on some news though in the 340B space. You know, I think a hot topic for the last few months has been all of the traction with regard to state level legislation around contract pharmacy protection. So we've got another state, Mississippi, now the fourth state that has passed a state level law that protects contract pharmacy provisions for covered entities in that state. So again, good news for covered entities in Mississippi.
Yeah. And it looks like also Virginia's close to the Contract Pharmacy Access Bill. So another state that's on the cusp of clearing the hurdles to enforce contract pharmacy and 340 programs. So that's good news.
Yeah, you have to imagine that we're going to continue to see a lot of progress on this front, given the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals upholding Arkansas's contract pharmacy law. So, you know, I think maybe there was some interest in tempering pursuit of contract pharmacy laws at the state level, wanting to know if the federal court was going to roll either in favor of pharma or in favor of favor of the states. And you know, that the big legal win for states and also covered entities that have been advocating for these protective contract pharmacy bills.
Right. Because we talked about it previously, so we don't go into detail, but at a federal level, you know, we have Representative Matsui's bill on the House side. The Senate, the Sustained 340B Act has some contract pharmacy provisions in it. It's just, you know, the question is, is there enough time left in this legislative cycle, especially with the reelection year for the House? Is there enough time to get anything done? And so I think my guess is states are looking at it and saying, no, we're not sure if there is, you know, maybe. I think everyone's holding out hope, but if not, then the states are just taking matters into their own hands until there's a federal legislation that supersedes that.
All right, good. Next item in the news is regarding Medicare Part B payments. So just to recap, CMS completed their repayment to covered entities of the Part B payment reductions that had been overturned by the Supreme Court. So I believe all of those payments have been made through the first quarter of this year. But the one outstanding question has been, you know, how are covered entities going to be, how are the Medicare Advantage plans going to address repayments for covered entities that had 340B reimbursements that were reduced for these Medicare Advantage plans, similar to what we saw with straight Medicare Part B. There's one health system out of Alabama, Baptist Health of Alabama, was suing Humana regarding the underpayment of 340B claims. And Humana is actually seeking a dismissal of the lawsuit, stating that, you know, the Supreme Court ruling doesn't apply to managed Medicare payment. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just, I mean, because it's something hopefully everyone's paid attention to. We've talked about when CMS or Medicare specifically went through their process to repay covered entities who were affected. And that there's also a component where, if you remember during this whole time, there were two ways in which a managed Medicare plan could reduce reimbursement. So one is if you didn't have a contract with that managed Medicare plan, then by default, you bill like traditional Medicare, which means you could get the, you would get that reduced reimbursement. Second, some contracts with managed Medicare plans actually state to bill the same way as Medicare. And that could be done in two ways, I guess. One, it could state bill the same you would traditional Medicare, or it would actually specify the same terms as traditional Medicare. And I guess in this case, Humana is making an argument that, well, this is a contract between the parties. And so regardless of what occurred, the contract should govern what the outcome should be. And here's what I don't know. I don't know what their contract says, right? Because if the contract, so they're saying they had a contract, but if the contract said to bill like traditional Medicare, and I guess they could make the argument at the time they did, but if traditional Medicare billed incorrectly, then I guess there's a question, well, then that means you billed in or reimbursed incorrectly. And so I don't know. I at least from my non-legal background, I'm not sure that actually defense holds. And so I guess we'll wait and see what the courts say. But interesting stance that they're able to contract at the time said one thing, even though it was incorrect. So yeah, I don't know. I'm curious to see where this plays out.
Yeah, if they set a precedent moving forward for other covered entities that are trying to seek some repayment from Medicare Advantage plans or other commercial non-government payers that, issued some type of payment cut over the years.
Well, and this is a big deal for Humana and the other payers, right? If that Baptist Alabama wins this lawsuit, I think the floodgates open up for, okay, well, we've now learned that you are responsible for repayment back to the appropriate payment level that Medicare is being held to. And so if you reduced reimbursement, to ASP minus 22.5%, thinking that you would be reimbursing the same as Medicare, well, now you're not. And can you retroactively apply that since CMS is being required to retroactively apply that?
Yeah.
And, I try and look at it from both sides, right? If I'm the payers, this is a tough one because we're talking about years, those budgets have closed. How do you find this money where, CMS at least has the opportunity to say, okay, well, we're budget neutral. We're just going to take it out of non-drug reimbursement for what, 10 years? I can't remember anymore.
16 years. I think
Sixteen years.
16 years and then they extended it to 16 years. So
that's right. The number's crazier than ever thought. Like 16 years, now a small percent over 16. So I guess it's more palatable, but I guess a payer could try and do something similar and argue, well, look, we've got to make up for this. At some point, because those savings already went into previous years. And, in the government's case, the best argument is, well, they were budget neutral then too, so they reallocated to hospitals based on dish percentage. And I'm not sure the payers can say that, right? That got reallocated. Most of these are for-profit payers, and so they got reallocated to their bottom line.
Yeah, maybe their margins, yeah.
Investors, if they're publicly held, yeah, who knows where it all went. I mean, some of it may have went back into premiums, right? So there's that argument. It went back to premiums so they could keep costs down so they could compete and so forth. But yeah, it's tricky. I can see the problem on both sides. But if I'm a covered entity, I'm kind of wondering, hey, you guys hit me pretty hard in that reduced reimbursement. I would like some of that back.
Yeah. I mean, just anecdotally, having had some conversations with folks out in the 340B hospital space, the impact for Medicare Advantage was on a similar level to what covered entities experience as far as reimbursements for straight Part B. So, probably accounts for half of the total. And if CMS, approved a $9 billion lump sum payment for the straight Medicare Part B, if you think Medicare Advantage, if there's a similar discrepancy there, I mean, these Medicare Advantage plans and commercial payers are going to have to come up with, we're talking billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's so I understand why they're going to fight it, but
and will we see that in premiums and other other increased expenses moving forward to account for that in the budget?
Yeah. I mean, and of course, I would hope that they're paying ASP plus six if they were billing like traditional Medicare now, at least even for the past year. But still, there's this historical look back and what do we do with it? I'm sure they're hoping that everyone they quietly just move forward. Yeah. Clearly, not going to happen. Now there's some eyes on it. Related to that, 340B report kind of reported on MedPAC had some findings around Medicare Part B payment rates and 340B ceiling prices. And I found it an interesting article because they're saying, gosh, the 340B hospitals are being reimbursed higher than the 340B ceiling price.
Yeah.
My first response is I almost wanted to swear, but I won't. We're going to keep this
family
friendly.
Right?
Like, no kidding. Yeah. I was going to use a different word, but no kidding. That's the whole point of 340B, that the covered entities get to save money on their drugs so that they can use it towards, you know, various things like charity care and keeping the doors open, everything else. It was never intended for Medicare or any other payer to actually harvest that savings for their own selves and their own reasons, right? If you're CMS, you've got budgets. If you're a private payer, you've got your rates that you contract negotiate with. 340B was never intended for you. Yeah. Even it was never intended for the federal government. It was only intended for the covered entities. That's where the savings are supposed to be, which then are supposed to use that savings to, again, keep doors open, improve programs, improve access, and provide financial assistance to patients who need. So I don't know what the point of the article is. Like, you know, they're like, well, they should be getting reimbursed ASP plus 6% and it should, or actual cost plus whatever. I'm like, that's not right. That wasn't the intent of the program. Congress never intended for, you know, Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans to be able to acquire the savings and to lower their costs. That they need to, you know, get a different federal program to do that, in my opinion. So anyway, that's my soapbox. I just, when these studies come out, I'm like, really?
Yeah, you wonder if it's to, you know, I guess pave the way for Congress to take notice and perhaps try to legislate some change to the 340B program that would impact how covered entities are paid for by Medicare, which is not part of the statute today.
Right, right. Because, you know, as long as I look at what outside of three, if the 340B program didn't exist, then those rates would be fine because the hospitals would be paying more for those drugs. They're just not happy that the hospitals or in grantees are paying less for those drugs, and they're still paying the same amount they would for the regular, you know, average sales price rate or whatever, the ASP rate. So any interesting articles, we always see those, and just felt like commenting today.
All right. We got a question about drug shortages. Rob, tell us what you have been hearing from clients and from other folks out in the pharmacy world around the pain of drug shortages today.
Yeah, I don't know about you. I used to be a pharmacy director, for those that don't know. And we, you know, this is over, gosh, dating myself, over 11 years ago now. And I was, you know, there's lots of drug shortages then. So whenever I'm on site with clients, sometimes I make the bad dad joke. I'm like, oh, wait, there's still drug shortages? I thought you guys fixed those already. They look at me with a very sarcastic
laugh if you say that, Rob.
Get the eye roll. So what's interesting is, you know, we track drug shortages partly because drug shortages are a significant impact on 340B, right? If you're accumulating an NDC and it's no longer available, then now you've got to buy it on GPO, or if you're subject to the GPO prohibition, a new NDC on WAC if you've never had any accumulation or history buying that new drug. And so there's that. Then there's also the accumulation issue, right? If you don't have NDC scanning at every single administration location, sometimes you're using a CDM crosswalk or some other crosswalk to get to the NDC, and you're having to update what NDC is likely on the shelf, right? And when you're changing NDCs because of drug shortages, that becomes very difficult, especially if you're CDM charge master base, right? There's all these issues. So it takes time and effort for the buyer. 340B staff have to do more work. So drug shortages are a big problem for 340B. In addition, you know, some people know that, you know, Trula are one of our divisions within pharmacy. They have an analytics program, and in that analytics program, we actually have a drug shortage risk score. So we're kind of just taking a lot of input and data that we have and trying to identify what drugs have risk, right? And as part of that, we kind of track some of this information. And of course, I can't help but say it, but my alma mater, the University of Utah, they support ASHP's drug shortage kind of database and everything else. And they just put together a 10-year trend. And here's what I didn't expect. So looking at a 10-year trend, you know, going back to 2014, over the years, it actually went from 301 in Q4 of 2014 down into like the 180s, 170s, even through 2015, 2016, 2017. Started creeping up into the 200s lately, but this last year, 2022, even starting in end of 2022, but all of 23, the drug shortages have been, this is actual active drug shortages by quarter, have been in the 300 plus range for the last year. And now of course, we don't have Q1 data yet. This probably was created and accumulated in Q1 of 2024. So Q4 of 2023, the end of 2023, the highest number of active drug shortages in an entire 10-year span, entire decade, 323 drugs were an active shortage. So that's crazy. So I guess I just share that. So if you're out there and you're like, gosh, it feels like we have a lot of drug shortages. Yeah, because you have a lot of drug shortages. We have a lot of drug shortages right now. So that's super scary. So I guess I feel for our, you know, hospitals and pharmacies out there just trying to get drug to patients and have drug on the shelf when you have that many drug shortages. Did you expect that, that it would be that high or the highest it's been in 10 years?
No, I mean, you know, when I'm out on audit talking with clients, I mean, there's still, you know, concerns and confusion around how to manage GPO prohibition risk with managing your drug shortage strategy. So get fielding questions about it, but not being in a dispensing role day to day and having to deal with swapping products and, you know, trying to, you know, track down, you know, product out on the gray market or do some borrowing and lending. I'm not feeling it acutely day to day, but have, you know, continued to get questions from clients around, well, how do we make, you know, our mitigation strategies work in the context of 340B.
Yeah, I don't know. You sometimes I'll see like big whiteboards by the buyers, and it's just full. I'm like, wow, that's a lot. Those are all shortages. Like, yeah, those are all our shortages right now. I was like, holy smokes, it's like a big whiteboard and it's full.
Yeah, it actually might make for an interesting discussion if we could bring some folks on that, you know, have a lot of experience in putting together drug shortage response efforts for a health system. If you're listening, if that's something you'd be interested in talking to us about, definitely reach out.
Right, because I mean, you're talking about first you have to deal with are there other NDCs in the same drug available? Outside of that, do you go into P&T and do auto substitutions? You know, how do you get buy-off from providers, especially if you're talking about different drugs in the same class or even different classes? Like, there's so many options you can go through and do. Do you go to the gray market? That's kind of scary, yep. Right? Especially with DSCSA and track and trace and all, everything going around there.
Drug pedigree stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's lots of factors. And oftentimes I think 340B compliance falls lower on the, you know, the risk stratification scale. It's, we've got to make sure we've got product. Do we have product that's safe? Can we safely use the product? And then the impact that it has on your 340B compliance is something that maybe needs to be set aside just to make sure that you can prioritize patient care.
Yeah. And, you know, and there are things like the private label products that we talk about, that there's things you can do, but you're not, just to remind everybody, if you use a GPO-based drug without accumulation, you do have to make sure that you communicate with HRSA on that. When the PHE ended, HRSA's option they gave to not report, just track it and have the data available if asked, kind of went away. So you do have to report that. And, you know, I'm sure HRSA, it's a double-edged sword for HRSA. How many times do they want to get reported on these 323 drug shortages that people might have to be by GPO on? The other thing is, I really thought Civica coming on board, really focusing on injectable drugs and drugs going short in the hospital acute situation would have helped improve it. And maybe this would have been worse without Civica and other manufacturers trying to focus on some of these drugs that have been going short. So I guess it could be worse.
All right. Well, that wasn't a very uplifting update, Rob.
All right, so then let's talk about HRSA audits instead.
Yeah, well, let's take a quick break, and on the other side, we'll get into HRSA audits, which may or may not be more painful or less painful than dealing with drug shortages. We'll be right back.
The 340B Unscripted podcast is brought to you by SpendMend Pharmacy. Do you wish you had another 340B expert on your team to help you manage your 340B program, but there's no time or budget available to hire an FTE? The SpendMend Pharmacy 340B Staff Augmentation Solution provides you with an industry expert to help manage your 340B compliance tasks. Visit spendmend.com and follow the pharmacy links to learn how you can maximize your 340B efforts.
Welcome back, everyone. All right, Rob, let's get into the HRSA DRL. When we last talked, we left off on number 7, which was documentation for your non-contract pharmacy, so your entity-owned or in-house pharmacies. We're moving on to section number 8, which is a category that a lot of covered entities don't have anything to provide. It's self-disclosure documentation. So one sub-bullet point under section 8, it says to provide self-disclosures that have been made to the Office of Pharmacy Affairs since the start of the sample period through the date of the on-site or the remote audit. So if there's been anything that you've identified in your self-auditing or your internal auditing that has triggered your material breach and required you to self-disclose to HRSA, HRSA would ask you during an audit to upload copies of that documentation. Fairly self-explanatory, right?
Yeah, I really haven't had clients need to do this, but I have heard that does occur. You might, especially maybe if you haven't had an annual independent audit or haven't been reading tightly and you're going through your data, like, oh my gosh, I've got this issue. And so some people might self-report. because it's or have self-reported in the data period. And the only reason that's important, because if you self-reported prior to receiving your letter, that's actually more favorably looked upon, right? If because it's going to be in your sample period, they might identify it, and you have self-reported. Yeah. It's not bad that it's there. So I think that's actually helpful, because that means you didn't do it after you received your HRSA audit letter. Now, if you receive your HRSA audit letter and you still self-report, I think it's fine. I know the one difference talking to auditors is sometimes you still get a finding for that because it's identified or self-reported after you received your letter. And there's this thought that, well, maybe you only did it because you're getting a HRSA audit and had a high probability of it being identified.
Yeah.
So I know those self-disclosures prior to receiving your letter are more favorable and might not end up in a finding, where the ones after may still end up as a finding.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. Section.
Oh, I got one more thing.
Yeah.
One of the clients I worked with weren't sure, and I wasn't sure, so we just uploaded it and waited to see what HRSA said. We just talked about GPO prohibition, and if you're in a drug shortage and you have to buy a drug on GPO, like a private label, and you let HRSA know, is that a self-disclosure?
Yeah. Well,
so we happened to have one in our audit period for one of my clients, and one of our covered entity hospitals, the Dish Hospital. And well, it has to be or subject to GPO prohibition, otherwise they wouldn't have the self-report. But it wasn't a self-disclosure. So we talked to the HRSA auditor, and her point was, well, I get what you're saying, but that's not exactly a self-disclosure, because a self-disclosure means you had a violation.
Yeah.
In this case, you didn't have a violation. You're just noting the fact that, look, I can't buy 340B drug. I can't buy WAC drug. I can only buy this private label product. So we went ahead and bought it to take care of the patient. And we're just letting you know we had to, because we couldn't buy it anywhere else. Here's all of our documentation. So it's not really a self-disclosure. It's just alerting her so that you had to buy a GPO drug because of a drug shortage. And so we deemed that not to be. So I just thought I'd put it out there that if you're wondering, is that a self-disclosure we have to report? At least according to HRSA auditor we worked with, she said, probably not. She said, you uploaded it, so leave it there. But more than likely, HRSA would not see that as a self-disclosure. Because if you do self-disclose, a lot of times you actually have to provide a cap. And no one's providing a cap when it comes to GPO purchases bought based on shortage.
Yeah. That's a great anecdote. I hadn't thought about that, because I've been working with some covered entities on the 340B price unavailable form that you submit to APEXIS, and hadn't ever considered that to be something that might need to be uploaded for a HRSA audit, unless it was requested during sampling. You're trying to track back purchases or trace accumulations. But yeah, that's a good call out. Can I move on now?
Okay.
Yeah. Medicaid, everybody's favorite.
I'm ready for the Medicaid duplicate discount. Let's go.
Yeah, so Section 9, this is your Medicaid fee-for-service billing documentation. This used to be Section 8, but they added the in-house pharmacy documentation that took 7 and that bumped everything down a number. So historically, I think of Medicaid documentation on the HRSA data request list as number 8, but it's now number 9 as of September of last year. The heading of this category is provide Medicaid fee-for-service billing documentation for each covered entity site by 340B ID. And pharmacy that carves in or provides 340B drugs to patients with Medicaid fee for service. So they're looking for a number of different things from each of your universes. So from your clinic and hospital administered drugs, from your entity owned retail pharmacies that are dispensing drugs to Medicaid patients, and two, if you are in the rare company of covered entities that have contract pharmacies that are dispensing drugs to Medicaid, if you're carving in from your contract pharmacies, there are a number of data elements that need to be provided to HRSA. So let's start with 9A. So 9A focuses on clinic-administered drugs. It says for clinic-administered drugs, and this would include essentially any provider-administered drug. So in the hospital setting or in the hospital-based clinic or in a grantee location, drugs that are given at your sites, provide a list of the states billed and the corresponding billing numbers. So that could be the NPI and or the Medicaid billing numbers listed on claims billed to Medicaid fee for service for each state. State that the billing numbers are listed on paper electronic claim forms to Medicaid fee for service, and may include your NPI or state assigned Medicaid number or both. So first thing that they're looking for is a table, and they provide a template for that table. The example that's in the HRSA data request list has 5 columns. First column is your 340B ID for your location, including all of your child sites, the states, the NPIs that you use to bill those states, any state-specific Medicaid numbers used to bill those states at those child sites. And then they add an additional column at the end where you can embed claim documents. We'll get to that in a little bit here. One additional thing that I've had 340B or Hertz auditors ask for is some description of what the state's billing requirements are. You'll see that in section A or 9B. It says describe each state's requirement for billing 340B drugs when dispensed at pharmacies or administered in the clinic. So in the table, they are looking for additional details around what your state's billing modifiers are that are required for fee-for-service. So if it's a UD modifier or a U8 modifier, as well as any other state-specific billing requirements. So you've got to compile a list of information for all of your child sites and for all of the states that you've elected to carve in, along with all of your billing information and your state-specific modifier information. Pretty hefty administrative task if you haven't done it yet, right, Rob?
Yeah, those it's quite, and if, especially if you have a lot of states. And then of course getting all those claims. And so if you think about, if you have a parent and lots of child sites and each child site has all the states also registered, because the other requirement is not just for the parent and just one bill, it's for every single child site. And so it almost makes me think sometimes, like, if your child sites really aren't billing out of state, maybe you don't put all the out of states on there, because you'll be asked to find them. Yeah. And of course, if you can't find them, then you have to try and find from the audit period, then they make you go, you know, up with the current state. If it's not current state, then you have to prove some other way that the NPI you have listed is correct. And so it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're talking about 9AI or 9A1. So the sub bullet point under the clinic administered drugs is, yeah, for each of these child sites and for every state that you carve in, you need to provide a Medicaid fee for service claim. So a claim image, it's usually a UB04 claim form for hospitals or a HICFA or CMS 1500 claim form for ambulatory clinics or grantee covered entities. You need to upload an example from each child site in each state. So yeah, if you've got 50 child sites and you carve in five different states, you could potentially have to identify 250 Medicaid fee-for-service claims that need to be uploaded for a HRSA audit. Really heavy lift gathering this information.
Yeah, it really is. It's a lot of work, especially, you know, and the administered drug side, I think people are used to. It gets tricky. I don't want to jump the gun too much on the in-house retail pharmacy side, but there's a new requirement on that side as well that can take quite some time if you have a lot of states there too.
Yeah. So one question that often comes up is, hey, we've got a child site. We've never had any fee-for-service activity. Or let's start this. Our child site didn't have any fee-for-service activity during the audit period. Is it reasonable to pull an older claim that predates your HRSA audit window to satisfy this requirement? What's your say, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, first they're going to ask for the audit period or more recent, right? Because audit period is the most recent two full quarters. So you might have almost a full quarter in between your audit data period and the time you're auditing. So you could look for a bill there. And then if not there, I've had HRSA say, yeah, you can go back in time past that. Yeah. Now, of course, there is some risk you go past that, because what if you updated your MEF or something changed in your process? So as long as nothing changed, I guess that's feasible. But there's a chance you just may not have any, especially if you're talking about out-of-state Medicaid, where maybe your ER, your main hospital might see it, but you listed it on all your child sites. But, you know, you're talking about an ambulatory clinic. They're probably not going to see all of your out-of-state Medicaid patients. So I see that quite a bit for covered entities. And yeah, and then HRSA does require something else. They still want something from you.
Yeah.
They're going to get their pound of flesh.
So what have you provided in the past when you haven't been able to produce a UB04 or a CMS 1500 claim form for a child site that's carving in? What are the options that HRSA is typically allowing you to upload?
You know, the main one that I think when we talked to the HRSA auditors, they asked for is some kind of enrollment form of some sort or something from that fee-for-service Medicaid program in that state that shows the NPI on it. So typically an enrollment form of some sort.
Yeah, Medicaid enrollment form or maybe an 855A, CMS 855A form. Yeah. So you may have to provide some additional documentation beyond a claim image for any child sites that don't have fee-for-service activity, but you've got them listed as carve-in. Maybe another day, Rob, we have a discussion around strategies for making those carve-in, carve-out determinations. It may not make a lot of sense to carve-in at some of these child sites where you just have no fee-for-service volume.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also a question, just because you have a state that you registered with or enrolled with, but you haven't seen activity in, you know, 2-3 years, do you really keep them on your MEF in the rare event that they come through? And if you don't, or what about the other states you haven't enrolled? How do you ensure you don't accumulate in those, just in case your billing department is attempting to bill and might get a reimbursement, right? So there's all these questions about how do you do that, because there's a lot of moving parts, departments outside of 340B of programs and outside of pharmacy to that you have to work with in order to get it right.
Yeah. Another question that comes up occasionally is, hey, can I provide HRSA with a UB04 of CMS 1500 claim form that doesn't have drug charges on it? Does it have to be an encounter where drugs were billed separately? What's been your experience in that regard?
You know, I think preferably that's what they want, but in some occasions we didn't have it, or what we had was like a vaccine, right? So it's some clinic like, look, we just don't get a lot of drug administrations, let alone out-of-state drug administrations, but we do have a vaccine. We're like, just let's send it. And they took it. Yeah. A lot of what they're looking for is that NPI number, right? Yeah. HRSA focuses on the NPI number in the Medicaid exclusion file as their primary test. They will ask, what requirements does your state have to prevent a duplicate discount? So there might be some accountability there. But what the main tests are looking at is, did you list the right NPI number on the Medicaid exclusion file and therefore your OPACE database, which is the finding, most common finding around duplicate discount, is that inaccurate OPACE database MEF, inaccurate MEF finding. So I think that's their primary test. So yeah, I think preferably they want a drug charge so they can see how that was billed and everything else. But outside of that, I think they're testing the NPI. So if the NPIs are, then great.
Yeah. Yeah. Looking at that box 56 for the NPI, box 57 for the Medicaid billing number. And I think that sometimes is confusing for covered entities that operate in states that have stated, look, we don't look at the Medicaid exclusion file. So all of our duplicate discount prevention efforts are related to the claim level modifiers that are put on the HCPCS codes. Well, HRSA still expects you to keep the Medicaid exclusion file up to date, even if you're in a state that doesn't rely on the MEF, practically speaking. So important not to overlook the importance of ensuring your Medicaid billing information is accurately reflected on the MEF.
Right. If you happen to be in a state where they rely on a modifier versus the Medicaid exclusion file NPI, you might avoid a duplicate discount finding, which would require payback, but you're still not going to avoid the inaccurate MEF listing. So you'll still take a finding. I mean, easier cap, no payback, but still a finding.
Yeah. Although I will say that working through a corrective action plan for the Medicaid exclusion file usually requires you to get confirmation from the state. Sometimes it's a little bit of a pain depending on the response time of the state Medicaid agencies, but you have to get confirmation from the state saying, hey, look, we didn't seek any rebates for these drugs because you guys were using the UD or the U8 or whatever the modifier is. So the cap, relatively easy for the covered entity outside of having to get some confirmation from states or from Medicaid administrators to confirm that no duplicate discounts were generated. So
you're right. Yep.
Yeah. So 9A is kind of like the legacy Medicaid billing information that HRSA would ask for. Since last year, they've added 9B and 9C, which focus on the retail pharmacy side. So 9B is the pharmacies that are not registered as contract pharmacies. So we think of these as your entity-owned retail or mail order or specialty pharmacies that are listed as shipping addresses and dispensing drugs in the retail space, but are not registered as contract pharmacies. Go ahead, Rob.
I see the other one to not forget about is sometimes you have home infusion pharmacies. Not a lot of covered entities have them, but they do. I've got a few covered entity clients that I work with that have home infusion that's part of the covered entity. Yep. And you have to include that billing as well in this pharmacy that is not registered as a contract pharmacy section.
Yeah. So just like what we described in 9A for the child sites, 9B requires you to put a table together that lists all of your essentially entity-owned pharmacies along with the Medicaid billing information. They want to see the bins and PCNs that you're adjudicating your Medicaid fee for service claims through, as well as the billing NPI that is on the NCPDP transaction. Also, got to provide example claim images for any pharmacies that are billing Medicaid fee for service. So for each of those pharmacies, essentially, this is new. We haven't had to do this before this year, but essentially they want you to get a snapshot in the pharmacy information system of the NCPDP transaction that provides details around how the claim was billed to Medicaid. So I think you're typically pulling a screenshot that shows the facility NPI or the pharmacy's NPI, and then the bin, the PCN that was billed. I'd probably include the group number, even though it's not specified here, because sometimes there's a little bit of overlap between commercial bins and PCNs, and then the Medicaid plans have their own unique group IDs. And then also providing a snapshot of what the claim level modifiers are for your retail claims. So that might be an SEC 20 or a BOCD 8 code. So again, a different tactic that needs to be followed in order to gather this information.
Yeah, and you're right. Being brand new, one thing I'll say is, right, everyone has a slightly different pharmacy information system in their retail pharmacy. Not everyone. There's a few major players there, but there are quite a few different options, and some of them do not have great visibility to the NCPDP submission, which means you might not be able to see some of those modifiers. You might not be able to see what your NPI is that you actually use for billing. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, I do have an in-house retail, or I have a home infusion or some other pharmacy other than your mix, your a pharmacy that where the drugs it given, 340B given, would be part of the UB04 or the HICFA 1500 as administered drugs, just think about, can you get this type of data? Can you get a screen capture? How hard would it be? And if not, then definitely start working with your vendor, whoever that vendor is who you operate your pharmacy information system out of, to see how you would get that information, because it will be required during a HRSA audit.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up home infusion too, because that's a pharmacy that might be doing some split billing. They may be billing claims on a medical benefit as well as through a traditional retail benefit. So you'll need to be able to extract billing claim information for both any medical claims billed out to fee for service from your home infusion pharmacy, as well as the retail pharmacy claims.
Yeah, that's right. Because some fall under, if they're Medicare, could fall under the Medicare Part B outpatient benefit, and some drugs would be Part D. So home infusion typically is a pretty big mix of both. And even retail pharmacies have some, but much, much less on the medical billing side. Majority of a retail pharmacy is going to be prescription drug benefit or through Medicare Part D if it's a Medicare patient. But yeah, that's a big one. But the one thing we didn't mention on A, I want to, that is a little different. And A, sorry, going back to administer drugs.
Yeah.
Years ago, when we'd have covered entities, say with very large offsite locations, like maybe a child site hospital, we would, you know, ask the HRSA auditor, hey, you know, it's a child site hospital. Can we just provide one UB04 for that, all those outpatient locations co-located in that same hospital, even though they're registered as separate child sites by requirement? And the answer was yes. I did try that. The last audit I did last week did have two hospitals. We tried that and the answer was no.
Mm.
So no more call, you know, no, hey, if it's the same address, can we provide one? No, if it's a child site, they want to see a UB04. So that's kind of hard because the bills all look the same, right?
Yeah, tell. You look at the UB04, right. You can't tell because the billing entity usually rolls up under the parent address and it has the facility NPI. The child site doesn't have its own NPI. So I don't know how you distinguish that as a child site claim unless the covered entity, you know, attests to that during the audit.
Well, you make your billing department really mad and say, well, we got to track down for every single location. We got to figure out where they had services at that location and build. Now the reality is it's all going to be the same NPI number. It's all the same billing process from the same hospital, but they still want your price. So we just hand wrote it at the top. This is child site, you know,
B.
And if they want to check it, we can go into the EHR and show them, yep, that's where the patient was located at discharge or whatever the case may be. But yeah, we had to do that. And it was painful. So I just, again, if you have lots of child sites, especially child site hospitals, man, this is something you want to start working on, making sure you're efficient at it, making sure your billing department knows in the event of a HRSA audit, it's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah. Have you ever had an experience where you weren't able to provide billing claim form or the covered entity just refused to upload it? I don't know. I've never encountered that myself. I don't know what the ramifications are. I'm guessing it could be some type of finding related to Medicaid exclusion file or duplicate discount. Is that, you ever encountered that or heard of that happening?
Not yet, because either we uploaded it or we tried to get the enrollment letter from the state. So either one of those two things occurred. But you know, one thing again, which I think you're right, we should talk about as a separate podcast episode, is what's the right way to set up your MAF and what things to consider and all those things. That could be a fun episode, and especially if we get someone who's got a lot of experience doing that at a covered entity level.
Yeah. All right. Let's keep moving. So 9A is hospital and clinic administered drugs. 9B is your entity owned pharmacies. 9C, it's contract pharmacies. So if you have any contract pharmacies, and this is real uncommon, Rob, I've maybe only seen it less than a, you know, handful of times. If your contract pharmacy is carving Medicaid fee for service in, you need to provide the same things that we just talked about for the retail pharmacies. You've got to have a table of all of those contract pharmacies, their billing information, NPIs, bins, PCNs that are included for fee-for-service billing. And then again, a copy of or a screenshot of the billing system showing how the claim was adjudicated to those Medicaid payer plans.
Yep.
And that, I mean, if you're carving in, if you've worked through the process of carving in your covered entity with maybe external contract pharmacies, you have to have had the state and HRSA come to an agreement. There needs to be a three-way agreement there, but now you're relying on your contract pharmacies to provide you that information. Same thing as they're doing with the billing, or not the billing claims, the retail hard copy. So, you know, if you are a covered entity that have some external contract pharmacies carving in for you, you want to make sure you have a good process in place and have rehearsed the exercise of gathering the billing claim information from those various pharmacy information systems.
Yeah.
All right. 9D, we already talked about the description of the state's requirements for billing 340B drugs. So most folks are baking that into the tables that we've described. So if you're a state that requires the UD modifier on hospital and clinic administered drugs and an SCC or submission clarification code 20 and a basis of cost determination of 08 on your retail claims, adding that detail into the table will satisfy section 9D. Any other insights around Medicaid billing information, Rob?
You know, only one, because we focused on people carving in. And I think previously in the other section, we did talk about if you're carving out, especially in the retail and contract pharmacy, that you do have to provide those BIN and PCN lists. We do. Yep. I think you and I are both in agreement. You should probably include group numbers. And it's just fee for service only. We just say, look, might as well just include your MCO Medicaid as well. Yep. But the other thing on the administered drug side that I just want to remind people, if you're carving out on your administered drug side, the one question you're going to get from HRSA is, well, okay, well, what about when it's self-pay or cash up front, and then it's then Medicaid's acquired at the end and then retroactively billed, right? So if people are familiar with that process in the hospital or in a clinic situation, an initial patient might show up and they don't have Medicaid, but you help them get signed up on Medicaid, and then there's this period of Medicaid that lets you go back in time to bill for that service. That's the whole point of why, you know, you're helping them get on Medicaid so they can help cover the service you're providing, so you're not going to eat that as a charity care cost, but that you actually get to get them on Medicaid. Now the patient's on Medicaid, full insurance, but one benefit is you get a bill for that. Well, when you first accumulate, it might show up as a self-pay or something else, right? It just show up as nothing insurance. And so you might accumulate that. And, you know, some people have good things like Medicaid pending or different flags, but some people don't, just as self-pay. And later on, it corrects the Medicaid and retroactively bills. Well, HRSA is going to ask, well, what do you do in that situation? And so you should have a mechanism or a process in place to look for retroactively billed Medicaid outpatients, right? So if it's an inpatient, it doesn't matter, but if it's an outpatient, it does. And be able to remove those accumulations from the accumulator, because now that they're Medicaid and you're carving out, you shouldn't keep those accumulations in there. Might cause you to go negative in some cases if you utilize that, but that's the right thing to do, and HRSA is asking. So just one tidbit for those of you that are carving out, but don't have a retroactive Medicaid process to manage those patients.
Great tip. That's a really good tip. Thanks for sharing that, Rob. All right. I think that's a wrap for us reviewing the HRSA DRL. We'll probably do this again next year if there are significant changes at the beginning of the next fiscal year for HRSA. Any last pearls of wisdom that you want to share, given your recent HRSA audit experience? Anything new or novel that you think might be helpful to share with folks?
Well, you know, I would say that I can't speak for any of the other vendors out there. I'm sure other vendors have good processes or programs in place, but I know for, you know, Greg, you and I and our auditing teams, you know, Jennifer does quite a few as well. We work with our clients, especially with one of our services. We basically provide weekly project management. We're getting in calls weekly once they get that letter, and we're moving through this data request, because it, especially with what we talked about, the Medicaid, the invoices, and we talked about purchasing section, some of this takes a long time, lots of effort, just creating the crosswalk. If you have lots of child sites, just dotting I's, crossing T's with your crosswalk, making sure that maps to your locations in your EHR. All of this takes time, and some people wait too long. Like, oh, I got, you know, 2 months to get the data in, and 2 weeks prior, they're trying to pull it all. It's not that simple. You really want to start as soon as you get that audit letter and put together a formal team. If you're not working with a vendor that's going to kind of step you through the process, then you just got to take the bull by the horns, create your own process to meet weekly with your team and bring in billing if you need to, bring in med staffing if you need to, bring in buyers if you need to, but get everybody in place and start assigning out every single data request item, making sure someone's assigned, and then hold them accountable to getting them in, because then you're going to want to review it. And does it need modification to fit the format for HRSA and all these things? So the best advice is start sooner than later, especially with the big items, especially with your purchasing files, especially with your Medicare, your crosswalk, and especially with these UB4 data collection if you have lots of child sites and lots of states you're billing. So that's my biggest thought. How about yourself?
I mean, that all sounds good, Robbie. A lot of these things that we've talked about, really encourage folks, start putting those pieces together, you know, gathering your invoices from all of your accounts, putting together your child site, trial balance, crosswalk. I mean, those projects usually take a lot of time to complete because you've got to source information and data from a couple of different stakeholders within your organization or even maybe outside the organization. And you've got a lot of other things you'll need to be doing, preparing for a HRSA audit. You want to stage some of that documentation ahead of time. So start today.
I got one more. Yeah. I thought of it because it came up on this audit. Okay, the other one, contract pharmacy agreements. Oh my heck. If you've got lots of contract pharmacies, you really have to map that out well. Yeah. And here's what I've seen with one particular client in general. They had their pharmacies listed, right? And it was one of these outfits. I don't want to mention any names of the contract pharmacies, but it was a chain. And they're ones that's they've acquired other chains, smaller chains or specialty pharmacies. Now they've got what would have been two or three different contract pharmacy chains. Now they're kind of all one. And so it's a little clunky because you had separate contracts. Well, we saw one contract where they're just moving or adding a central fill. In fact, the central fill is moving locations. And so they just did an amendment to amend that central fill. But as part of that amendment, they accidentally redid the table for one of the other chains, right? So this table is going to replace in its entirety. They never added the table to the amendment. So what effectively happened when you look at it, oh, the last amendment that had that table, yep, those contract pharmacies are listed. This amendment takes care of the new change. No, you have to read those amendments carefully. If they accidentally remove or replace a table and that previous table is where your contract pharmacies were, you just lost your contract pharmacies. And in an audit, you might be held accountable to that. And so just pay attention to follow the timeline for the original agreement through the amendments and make sure that either tables are not being replaced if you're going to rely on an older amendment or an older contract for the table for those contract pharmacies, or if it is being replaced, make sure they're all accurately replaced on the newest amendment possible, right? So you got to put every single contract pharmacy and amendments all in order and start from the most recent one, work your way back, and make sure that all contract pharmacies currently registered are listed appropriately and not accidentally deleted by the most recent amendment. So that's the only last piece I'll have. And other than that, if you have a lot of contract pharmacies, that's another piece. Holy smokes, that takes a long time.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking of one thing that's not on the data request list, but the covered entities that have provided this, the beginning of a HRSA audit, really sets a nice tone. It's just a brief presentation. I always encourage folks, put together a quick presentation for the opening conference of the audit, explains what your organization is, what your scope of services are, how you're overseeing the 340B program, and highlight some of the things that you're doing by virtue of benefiting from the 340B program. Really sets, I think, the appropriate tone for what ends up being a fairly long couple of days of auditing. So it's always nice to start off on the right foot and kind of make sure everybody understands, you know, the value of the 340B program and the importance that the 340B program has to the covered entity.
Yeah, and I 100% agree, because people always ask. I said it's not absolutely required. Some HRSA auditors might actually ask for it. I've actually had that occur. Yep. Some say it's up to you. Something you can ask in your opening conference, if that's something like. But I think I agree with you. I'd recommend doing it. The one caveat, some HRSA auditors will have you upload that as data. Yep. So whatever you put in that presentation, make sure you're not putting anything you don't want to upload as data to HRSA. Yep. So definitely be cognizant of what you're putting into that presentation.
Good. All right. Well, I think that's a wrap for us, Rob. You're going to Asembia. I think by the time we talk again, you'll have gone to the Asembia conference in Las Vegas. You guys are there April 29th to May 2nd. Aiden wanted me to have you plug that.
Yeah. We got a 4 or 5 of us going down. It's a specialty pharmacy conference. So I really like those. You know, a little different space, but we'll be down there in Las Vegas. And if you're down there, you know, shoot me an email. We've got some lunches and dinners that we're always trying to line up. And if not, just we're doing a booth. I think we're doing a booth. How do they say that? We're doing a booth. Okay. So definitely. I have to second guess that. We go to enough conferences. I'm like, wait, sometimes we don't do a booth. We just show up. But I think we have a booth. So in any case, reach out to me if you're going to be down there and maybe we can meet up. That'd be fun.
We'll throw the booth number in the show notes here.
Or the fact that we don't have a booth number.
Right. I'll make up a booth number like I've done.
I might get fired. Yeah,
6,000, booth number 6,000.
If anyone has a job for me, since I don't even know where I'm going and what I'm doing.
All right, Rob, it's good catching up with you. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you the next time. Take care.
All right, thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Hey, we're back. We just realized we don't have a booth. Rob, tell us a little bit about what you guys will be doing while you're there.
Yeah, so we did have a booth last year. I was like, wait, I don't think we have a booth. We don't have a booth. We actually try and meet with a lot of our vendor partners, right? So that are down there. There's wholesalers, there's TPAs, even some of the manufacturers that are down there. We have a purchasing platform with Trula. And so and the Trula system is really for procurement for hospitals. But in doing so, we try and work with manufacturers that are working on behalf of the covered entity health systems, especially with central distribution centers. So there's some work around that. And on top of that, we do have quite a few health systems down there. And so we like to meet with them. But because it's kind of more of a specialty pharmacy conference, it doesn't really fit kind of like a 340B booth per se. Yep. And so we just go and attend. So it's one of the few conferences we go to that we don't have a booth, but we're definitely meeting with people as much as we can. So again, any health systems that want to talk shop while we're down there, it's 340B or procurement or analytics that we have, please reach out. More than happy to set up a meeting and have a discussion on there. But thank you for letting us hop back on and just clarify that we won't have a booth down there, but I will be down there.
All right. Well, enjoy Las Vegas. I hope the conference goes well. And everyone, thanks again for listening. We'll catch you later.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to 340B Unscripted. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.